It's Friday on Daily Delivery. I'm Michael Rand. Glad to be back for another day, final show of the week. Hope everyone's having a great day out there today. Really good show coming up. Couple different guests on today's show. A little bit unusual. Usually we only have one, but today wanted to get two. John Marthaler will join me to talk soccer in just a little while. Minnesota United, another Emmanuel Reynoso saga. Stop me if you've heard that before. We don't know when he will play again for the Loons. He went back to get an appointment in Argentina, and now we don't know where he is and when he's coming back. So John and I will get into that here in just a little while. In addition to what has been a good start to the season for the Loons, they have a home match tomorrow night against Houston and a chance to move up the standings even more. Jim Suhan will join me in just a couple minutes here from the Masters. He is out there covering that tournament for the Star Tribune. Interesting first round. Not everybody finished, so a longer day today. But looks like the weather is cooperating, and some good updates from Jim. So listen to that in just a minute. Some Wolves news. Might be the re-debut of Karl-Anthony Towns. Get to that at the end of the show. Coming back from injury, just two games left in the regular season, and important ones at that. First, though, what did I miss? Let's talk Vikings for a few minutes at the top here. Kwesi Adofo-Mensah, Vikings general manager, had his pre-draft news availability on Thursday. That was 2 weeks from the draft. Now we're just a little less than 2 weeks from the draft. You can listen to more insights on that. Ben Gessling, Andrew Kramer did a Access Vikings podcast Thursday, so I'm not going to spend too much time on this subject. But there was the one takeaway theme from Kwesi that I wanted to get into at the start of the show, and that was him doing everything he could, rightfully so and probably truthfully so, to convince us that the Vikings are not necessarily A, locked in on one quarterback, and B, locked in specifically on absolutely having to take a quarterback. Now, why is that important? The Vikings are trying to gain some sort of leverage here, right? Like, everybody knows that in a perfect world, they will draft a quarterback, right? They have a very identified quarterback need. They are not being secretive about scouting quarterbacks. They've been talking about this quarterback class for years, as it turns out, as kind of the one that they're looking at to build their quarterback of the future. So with so many potential quarterbacks available in the first round, it puts them in an interesting position. They have the number 11 pick. They traded for the number 23 pick with Houston a couple weeks ago to give themselves a couple first round picks to either A, move up the board again to draft somebody, B, to stay there at 11 or 23 and take someone, or C, just kind of see how it all unfolds, and if it doesn't unfold how they want it, pick somebody else. Now, I think we all know, or at least we believe, that the most likely outcome here, what they are really positioning themselves to do, is make another move up the board to either get Drake May, probably at number 3, in a trade with New England, or get J.J. McCarthy in a trade with either Arizona or the Chargers. But of course there are, you know, potentially 5-6 first round quarterbacks in this draft. If you go from Caleb Williams, presumed number 1 overall, Jaden Daniels, probably number 2 to Washington, Drake May then becomes kind of that trendy pick as the number 3 pick. McCarthy kind of slots in somewhere in there, although we're not entirely sure where. And then you've got Michael Penix and you've got Bo Nix. So they get 6 potential options. And what Kwesi's trying to say is, hey, we've got options there. We aren't locked in on one guy. We kind of are going to look at relative value. So here was kind of the big takeaway quote from the day.
Again, when you go back to the team element in value, it's so I think there's multiple guys that we are in love with just on a outright basis, but there's also other guys that we're in love with given what, if we get them at a certain value, what they'd also be able to come with, right? So as I talked about earlier, skill set wise, if you're talking about ability to overcome context, well, if the guy's got less ability, but we have assets to go get somebody who's not going to put him in that situation, those things add up too. So it's really those things. And I want to say that I think that's a great question. I love how, you know, Kevin and a lot of people involved in this decision, a lot of times evaluators can be a little one-track mind. This is the guy and nobody else. That's not how it's been. We've really come to appreciate how guys get to their answer a different way, and I think that's going to serve us well.
obviously there are things to like about every quarterback in the draft. So this is there's truth to what Kwesi's saying. What we don't know is how much truth there is there, right? Like how much they would be comfortable taking the fifth or sixth quarterback in the draft and building around that guy, taking a Penix or a Nix as opposed to moving up probably to have to get someone like Mayer McCarthy. How much, what their comfort level is with the price, what the walk-away price is. Kwesi talked about the walk-away price for some of these guys, knowing kind of that you have to get that quarterback. The quarterback is the most important position in sports, and if you get it right and you get your guy for 10 years, nobody really cares what you gave up. So them trying to balance all that, trying to gain some of this leverage back, trying to convince teams that they're not taking a quarterback or moving up to get a quarterback at all costs is a fascinating kind of dance that they will do for the next 2 weeks. We won't see it fully play out until draft night, but we did hear from Kwesi on Thursday, and I thought that was interesting. Let's bring in Jim Suhan, Star Tribune columnist from Augusta once more. Jim, how are you this morning?
I'm good. It's another beautiful day here. A little rainy yesterday, but it's gorgeous out there today. I think the weather has cleared out. It's going to be just perfect conditions for the next three rounds.
What did we learn Thursday aside from, yeah, a few people have to finish up play, but looked like they were going pretty low in a lot of cases.
Yeah, Scheffler played just the perfect first round for someone positioning themselves to win a championship. Zero stress, zero bogeys. He made golf look easy, and it is not easy, especially in these wins. He's just such a great player, and he's putting pretty well, which is the key for him. If he puts well, he wins. It's just that simple. The story of the day is DeChambeau. This is a guy who has gone through all kinds of crazy phases in his life. I wrote about it today and his career. He's a really weird, fascinating guy. And here he is he's still a very big, strong guy and he still swings fast, but he's not going for maximum speed anymore. He's not maximum size anymore. He designed the irons he's playing with after changing companies. He has a different swing and he's much humbler right now than he ever has been before. At least he's pretending to be humbler, which would not be a bad thing. and he goes out and shoots 65 on a relatively tough scoring day because of the swirling winds. And he just just hit great shots. And he looks like he has a little more feel with this new swing than he had with the older one, where he just tried to overpower the golf course. So, and he gave an interview yesterday where, again, he tried to be humble. I'm not sure he's capable, but at least he tried. But, DeChambeau at this stage, with all the different things he's tried in the world of golf to come out and shoot 65 in round one, is what, even if he doesn't play well the rest of the way, it's kind of amazing.
Explain to me, and I read your piece on him. Explain to me and the listener just the difference. His irons are basically like he's got theories about his irons and he's designed his own irons. Tell me more about that if you could.
Yeah, it's really golf geeky stuff, but
which I like. Yes.
Yeah. So a lot of woods, especially old, like persimmon type woods, woods. They built in what they call bulge and roll, basically building in some, so if you hit it on the toe, the ball would start out to the right, but it would naturally curve back to the left toward the target. If you hit it on the heel, it would naturally start off to the left, but it would curl back to the right toward the target. This kind of way of building in forgiveness. And he basically has designed, with TaylorMade, has designed irons that basically have bulge and roll built into his irons. So because he felt like, he swings really hard. If you swing really hard and you hit it on the toe, it could be a nasty push or nasty slice. There could be a nasty pull hook. You could ruin your entire round. So I basically try to build in forgiveness that fits his swing exactly. So it's kind of the ultimate club fitting, a guy actually designing something for his particular fundamentals.
That's interesting. Local angle too, right? Van Ruyen played pretty well.
He did. I walked with him yesterday and he was at one point, he was 4 under. And it was amazing because he was playing great. We get to the eighth green, which is kind of when you go back uphill and start dealing with high winds again. And it went from being really placid to being just gale force winds.
Yeah.
And that's when his round. And then to his credit, I wrote about it. On 9, he hits what he thought was a perfect shot. The wind pushes it over the green. It lands under some dude's chair. They have to move out of all the 18 chairs to give him a place to hit. And then he makes a birdie from, a nasty downhill sliding. But that was. After that, he struggled. Back 9, he struggled. He hit one in the water on 15 and just tried to hold on. And he ends up minus one, which is a pretty good score yesterday. It's not going to position him to win the tournament, but that wasn't expected. But he, 2020, he had to withdraw because of a back injury. 2022, he didn't make the cut. So I think the realistic goal for him would be to make the cut here.
Yeah, that's a good goal for anybody. What about Tiger? We talked about him on Wednesday, just how many eyeballs will be on him no matter what. He gets through some of his round, plays reasonably well, but this be a pretty big test for him, right, to have to play. Does he have 23 holes to finish up today?
Yeah, it will be a really big test because he had to warm up early this morning, play whatever number of holes, take a little break, then go back out for a second round. For a guy who's limping and dealing with all kinds of back and leg issues, and he's 48 years old, it's going to be quite a test. I will say that what he's already done is amazing. Given these tour players talk about it all the time. You cannot replicate playing under pressure and having to hit touch shots that you can't set up for yourself. He's 48 years old. His body's a wreck, and he's out here, and he's at even par at the last I checked.
Yeah.
I mean, that in itself is a victory. If you were writing a movie script, you'd want him to win this week. That wasn't going to happen. If he makes the cut, that's an incredible achievement. I would say just playing well over any length of time, as he's doing right now, is pretty amazing.
Final thing for you, Jim. What else are you watching on Friday? What do you think will be the key storylines as we kind of head into the weekend?
Yeah, at this point, it's just you just watch the leaderboard and walk around the course and find good stories. And so, I mean, you always hope when you cover a golf tournament, there are interesting stories the first couple of days. So you're not right. You don't want to have to write Scottie Scheffler four straight days,
right?
Yesterday I got to write about DeChambeau and Van Ruin. I'm hoping somebody else interesting pops up with the leaderboard who's a good story. I hope Van Ruin plays well enough that he's worth writing about still. My gut at this moment tells me that I'm going to end up writing a lot of Scottie Scheffler, though. He just looks great.
Which is, I was going to say par for the course. Didn't even mean to say that, but birdie for the course maybe for him. Because, like you said, if he's making his putts, does he just look as usual, or is he striking the ball even better in that first round?
I mean, he's just hitting it great. Okay. And he's been hitting it great all year. He's by far the best ball striker in the world. And that doesn't mean he hits it far than everybody. It means he hits it far with control of his ball flight, control of his, what they call flighting the ball, which is picking the trajectory. He can work it left. He can work it right. He can land it softly. He can hit his long irons and hold a green. He's just an amazing artist, really. And that's what I love. He talked about it yesterday. So many of these guys are out here looking at the track, man, and trying to get perfect, perfect spin and maximum distance. And he's out here just playing around and hitting different shots because that's what you have to do in a round. You got to figure out, how do I hook it around this tree? How do I hit a soft fade here? How do I hit a low here? He really is more artistic than most of these guys, which is fun to watch.
Awesome. Well, we'll be following the tournament. We'll be following your coverage in the Star Tribune and online. Jim, appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Great. Thank you, Michael.
Great stuff from Jim. Should be a fun second round on Friday. And like I said, follow his coverage in the Star Tribune and on StarTribune.com for the entire weekend.
Royal Credit Union smart checking accounts offer no monthly fees and no minimum balance. Enjoy financial freedom when you open your Royal Credit Union smart checking account online at rcu.org/gochecking. Insured by NCUA.
Let's bring in John Marthaler right now. Friend of mine, friend of the show, but also will be doing a lot of soccer coverage for the Star Tribune for the foreseeable future. Jerry Zagoda normally covers the Loons for the Star Tribune. Will be helping out with the Timberwolves in the playoffs for as long as that goes. And John will be helping out with Minnesota United as he so capably does. John, how you doing?
Not too bad. I was at training yesterday and I made a joke to new Loons coach Eric Ramsey about being a substitute teacher and we were going to just play heads up 7-up. And that's how I found that they don't have heads up 7-up in Wales.
Well, I guess that you got to learn somehow. It's all about education. Speaking of education, John, what is your 1990s indie rock baseline knowledge?
I was alive and listening to the radio in the 1990s, but it was Western Minnesota radio. So I'm not going to claim any sort of knowledge here.
So you're not maybe, are you familiar with the band The Lemonheads?
I remember the band The Lemonheads, but if you ask them ask me to name any songs from the Lemonheads, I'm not sure I could do it.
So Lemonheads were kind of a classic late 80s, early 90s band, kind of became popular really in the early 90s. I think it was their fifth studio album. Now, Evan Dando is the lead singer. He's kind of the singer-songwriter for them. Juliana Hatfield joins them in 1992, becomes part of this kind of power pop, kind of, you know, really good poppy kind of stuff. They have some hits right in there. 1992, they released their fifth studio album, I do believe. It's called, and the title track, which became one of their biggest hits, title track to their 1992 release, which is probably their best-selling, biggest, most popular album, is called It's a Shame About Ray. It's a Shame About Ray is a really popular song. Now, I never really knew what it was about. It was just a poppy song. Weird thing about me is I don't pay that much attention to the lyrics of songs generally, even though I am a writer, even though you would think that would be important to me. I don't pay that much attention to lyrics. I can sing along to It's a Shame About Ray, but I looked up It's a Shame About Ray as we were getting ready to do this conversation. Track three on the CD, by the way. And apparently Evan Dando said in an interview with Kathy Lee and Regis, this is how long ago this was, that the song is, quote, a story about a specific imaginary person who has disappeared. So with that as a backdrop, John, It's a Shame About Ray, Emmanuel Reynoso, the Loons player who has gone missing again, a real person, not an imaginary person. Get me up to speed on this story.
Well, what seems to have happened is that after the Loons played on March 16th, it actually happened to be Emmanuel Reynoso's first game of the season. He was out with a leg injury coming up to that, but he played part of the second half again on the 16th. And the following week, the Loons had a bye week. And so what they did was they set up an appointment for him to run back to Argentina during this 2-week break and get his green card all set up. And the reason they wanted to do that was not out of some goodness of their heart, really, but because if he has a green card, then he counts as a domestic player, not an international player. MLS has a limit on the number of international players you can have on your roster. And so if he was to do this, it would give Minnesota some roster flexibility, especially as they come up to the summer, which is the traditional time to bring in new players. They could look at more international players. They would have a little more flexibility to that. And it all made sense. They got this appointment set up for him. He was supposed to have it on Monday, the 25th, which he could have the appointment. He could then get on a plane, get back. And when Minnesota was playing in Philadelphia on the 30th, everything would be fine. What seems to have happened based on their statement is that he missed that green card appointment and they has not returned yet. And so for the third time in just over a year, really, he's gone missing and with no return date in sight. What the Loon statement said was, we have no updated timeline on his return.
Well, I mean, this is not the Loon's fault, but they probably do know at this point that sending him out of the country is an exercise. It is a bit of a fool's errand if you expect him to come back, but you should expect somebody to come back, right? Like, this was a simple thing. You would think you can go there, get this taken care of, and come back. What? This has got to be frustrating for them at this point, because it keeps happening, and he is clearly their best, most talented player, has been for years, but you don't know what you can count on with him at this point.
Well, You know what you can count on when he's here.
Of course,
you do know. You do know when he goes back to Argentina. At this point, you have to say if he's in Argentina, it's anybody's guess when and if he'll come back. That seems the way things are going to be with him. And people, every so often, and this was especially true last year, it's like, well, he's young. He's not young. He's 28 years old. If he was 16 years old or 17 years old, you could sort of see how this could happen, but at 28, you got to be able to trust that the guy can get himself on planes when he's supposed to be where he's supposed to be.
Now, they dealt with this for a lot of last year. They finally got him in and he played well when he was here. They missed the postseason. Adrian Heath gets fired. They reshuffle the deck with pretty much everything now. New leadership in place. How do you think new leadership will treat this differently potentially than how it has been dealt with in the past? Do you feel like this is a case of they'll deal with this differently because they think of it differently, or will it be an accumulation of things? Will have them treat it differently? Or do you think it'll be, hey, more of the same, hope he comes back, and when he does come back, we know what we're getting?
Well, I think there's two things that play into that. For one thing, you have a new regime, and they're going to want to come in and have certain standards and set a level that they expect everyone to be at. And this is a big test for any new coach, new sporting director, chief soccer officer, whatever you want to call Khaled Al-Ahmed. But it's a test in the sense of, all right, who's really in charge here? It's a little bit like anything where you're trying to establish who has the power in this. And the other thing that plays into it, I think, is that when you're looking back at last year and in previous years, a lot of what the team was set up to do was centered around Emmanuel Reynoso, especially offensively. But a lot of the team and how they were going to play both offensively and defensively was geared a little bit to say, how can we maximize what Emmanuel Reynoso is good at? How can we minimize what he's not good at? I don't think under Eric Ramsey with the new regime, I don't think that's necessarily true anymore. I think they're looking and saying, what do we think is the best way to play? Not what is the best way for us to play with Ray, but what is the best way for us to play? And does Emmanuel Reynoso fit into that? So with that in mind, I think they have a different feeling, or I would expect they have a different feeling about whether Emmanuel Reynoso is here or not. And again, you go back to the three line statement they had, and you can parse a lot out of this, but the last line of it was, our entire focus is on the players and staff who are here. I think I get the sense from just from that what they are focused on is who is what they can control. And if Emmanuel Reynoso is going to stay in Argentina, they're just going to let that slide, figure out what to do from there.
And in contrast to past years, they've fared quite well without him this year. I'm sure they could certainly use a player of his caliber, but off to a good start this year. You know, it was a great start. They've had a loss and a draw in their last two. They play Saturday at Allianz against Houston. But like you said, the style is different this year, not so much predicated on his talent, and it has yielded some positive results so far. What is different? If you're just kind of catching up to this team right now, what is different this year from kind of almost the entirety of the Adrian Heath regime?
Well, I think one of the things that we're going through right now is it effectively because Cameron Knowles was the interim coach. He coached the first three games of the season. Then in comes Eric Ramsey. He's operating sort of in the same direction, in the same framework as maybe Cameron Knowles was, but it's not going to be the exact same. He's going to come in with his own ideas, his own differences. And so it's almost like the Minnesota started out with two wins and a tie, then fired their coach, although he's still an assistant coach for the first team. But it's almost like they fired their coach and now they've hired a coach midseason and they're trying to figure out how they're going to play. So I think some of the original things that were particularly exciting for fans, especially when you look, just go back to the first half of the first game against Austin, all of a sudden you've got guys who you feel like have not been over the midfield line in two seasons, like Will Trapp, who's a defensive midfielder, generally sits back. All of a sudden, in about the third minute of that game, you see Will Trapp sprinting at the opposing center back because it's an opportunity to press, it's an opportunity to trigger something. And I think that was exciting for a lot of fans because they have seen a lot of the same in terms of sort of a cautious kind of press. They weren't a pressing team. Minnesota wasn't the kind of team that would sit back in a very deep low block and try to only do counterattacks, but they certainly were not having the defensive midfielder rush at a center back and try to pressure him into a turnover. So you have sort of this original thing where all of a sudden people said, oh my gosh, the Loons are a high pressing team now. This is going to be full energy drink soccer, New York Red Bulls. They're going to just be getting in wars all over the field and just trying to punt the ball up the field and then win it back. That's not what is happening under Eric Ramsey. It's not exactly what it looked like before under Adrian Heath, but I think from what I saw last week, I think it's more like that than the crazy pressing that we saw in the first half of the first game.
But the crazy pressing was working, but is that just not sustainable? I would have assumed that they would have been trying to sustain a similar style because they knew eventually Ramsey was coming in. So you're telling me there's a little bit of a change already from where they were playing earlier in the season under Cameron Knowles.
Yeah, I think it's hard to look at anything that small of a sample size, especially when you look at like Austin, who was missing their best player the first game of the year. Yep. It's the first game of the year. They're just coming off preseason. how you play against a team like Austin that's probably not very good is not going to necessarily be how you play the whole season. I think with a high pressing attack like that, you sometimes can look at it a little bit like back in the, to go back to the 90s, like you're doing with music. I'll talk about football in the 90s.
Yeah.
Everybody ran the ball back in the 90s. And then there was the run and shoot. That was like this whole different thing.
Yeah.
And you look at the run and shoot and can it be successful in small doses? Yes. Was it necessarily successful in the long term? Not necessarily. So it's a little bit the same with the high pressing. You have to sort of pick and choose your moments with a lot of that stuff, or you have to be entirely committed to the bit with a team like New York. And I'm not sure Minnesota has the players for that. They got a lot of veteran players. They don't necessarily have a lot of 22-year-old guys who are going to sprint for 75 minutes at a time.
So where are the supporters at right now with, you know, the whole transition, and just how do you feel like it's gone in general? Because it felt like the offseason was messy, right? Like we were waiting for a lot of things to happen, and then they got off to a good start. You're like, okay, all is forgiven. How do you think people are sitting with this right now?
I get the sense, by the time the Adrian Heath era was over, I got the sense that whether people were particularly happy with Heath or particularly angry about Heath, most people just wanted to move on to the next thing. I think most coaches reach that point where you've sort of seen what they can do. The Minnesota Wild have reached this point 15 times in the last 15 years where you get to you sort of see the end game and, well, let's move on to the next thing. I think that there were a lot of people who were really angry about Adrian Heath, and there were a lot of people who were pragmatic enough to look and say, well, they made the playoffs 4 years in a row and nobody else did that. And so that's something to be proud of and see it as an accomplishment. But I think both of those camps were ready to go, well, this is something new, and we're ready for something new with this team. And so I think people are excited in terms of, well, let's see what's going to happen. Let's see how they're going to build. And they already have come through a pretty tough early schedule, and they've got 11 points in six games. That's not world beating. They're currently fourth in the Western Conference standings. They're second if you take into account how many games they've played, but they certainly have the vibe about them right now is that they feel like they can play with anybody. That was not always the vibe over the last 4 or 5 years.
Now, obviously Reynoso's barely played. I mean, he was injured, and now he's gone missing again. What's individually, aside from, you know, kind of what style they're playing, what are we seeing from some of the individual standouts so far this year?
Well, I think the guy that people have been most excited about so far this year is Tanny Oluwaseyi, because he's like, he's the backup striker. He comes in for the last 10, 20, 30 minutes.
Good things happen.
He makes good things happen. He gets out there. He sprints. He scored a couple of game tying goals at home to rescue a couple of points for Minnesota. He set up one in the first game. It's fun to have a guy like that where you just look, and when he comes on, it's like, yes, here we go. This is going to be, something's going to happen. This is going to be exciting. So I think if there's been any standout so far, we're talking about a guy who's played 100 some minutes over six games or whatever, but it's still, I know that when he came on against Real Salt Lake last week, there's sort of like a rush through the crowd. Like, all right, here we go. We're going for it here. This is happening.
What about the regulars though? Like what's becoming, if there's, let's say there's an extended period with no Reynoso, what's the identity? Who are the key components that are holding this all together, aside from, you know, hey, it's a team effort, 11 guys, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I think that one of the big keys, if Reynoso is out, you look at the guy who's going to be playing the position that Reynoso would mostly occupy. And that, I think, is setting up to be Robin Lud, who has, he's been a guy that they've constantly said over the last 4 or 5 years, he's one of our most important players. And yet he played right wing. He played left wing. He was a striker for a while. He's played this position where he's playing sort of as an attacking midfielder. He was even sort of a more defensive midfielder, a box to box midfielder for a while. They sort of put him wherever they can fill him in. And I think they can sort of set themselves up to play in a way that is more balanced without Emmanuel Reynoso. But also, if you're in that attacking midfield role and you've got guys in front of you, you do need to do, he's going to need to take on the brunt of sort of that chance creation work. They can spread out the offense and try to push the ball down the wings and cross it more and all that kind of stuff. But at some point, there's going to have to be somebody that can get on the ball in the middle of the field and make something happen. And whether Robin Lutt can be that guy, I think, is still somewhat of an open question.
A couple more things for you, John Marthaler. One, is this sustainable? Like you said, they're second, kind of the second in kind of points per game, at least at this point. Small sample size, obviously 6 games, but do you feel like their success is sustainable this year?
I think you look at last season and they didn't make the playoffs. It was kind of a struggle the whole year. And so coming into this year, if you just looked at the standings and looked at the guys they brought in, none of whom were a bit particularly big name or anything special, it was pretty easy to just go, all right, well, Minnesota finished 10th last season or 11th or whatever they finished. They'll probably finish 11th again this season. And then they get out on the field and you see the players they have, and it's like, oh, you know, this team is not necessarily a bad team. They have good players. Their depth is the same as any MLS team's depth, where it's a little, you know, a little bit like, well, we're not, if they have a ton of injuries, they might get in trouble. But ultimately, I think they have a good lineup. They have good players. And if everybody's pulling in the same direction and everybody knows how they're going to play and they're not at the whims of how Emmanuel Reynoso is playing, I think you can look at the lineup they have and say, yeah, I think they can play with anybody.
What are the odds, John, last thing, that the supporters will change the victory song from Wonderwall to It's a Shame About Ray on Saturday if they win?
I'm just going to go anecdotally when I look down and see who's in the crowd, but I'm going to go ahead and say that most of those people are younger than you and me. And so they're probably not going to remember the Lemonheads with such fondness and above all detail that you remember them.
Came out 32 years ago. That doesn't make me feel any younger, John, but right. We'll deal with it. Appreciate it as always. Read John's coverage in the Star Tribune as well as many other places, your excellent Substack, everything else. John, appreciate it, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Always good to catch up with John, and like I said, he'll be writing more in the Star Tribune, startribune.com, for the next month or so on Minnesota United. Jerry Zagoda, our typical Loons writer, will be doing some more Wolves coverage as they ramp up for the playoffs. So look for more of John's coverage. Maybe I'll have him on the podcast one or two more times in the next few weeks here to kind of catch you up to speed on all things Minnesota United. Let's finish with the cooler. And speaking of the Wolves, might see Carl Anthony Towns tonight against the Hawks. Wolves have just 2 games left in the regular season. Towns has been cleared for full 5-on-5 practice workouts. You've been seeing the videos of him scrimmaging, dunking, things like that. Looks pretty good in that comeback from that meniscus injury in his knee. So we will see how he comes back, what he looks like when he comes back, how much he is ready to go full speed, how he fully reintegrates himself into this team and this offense are key questions they need answered before the playoffs start, because he is obviously one of their most important players. They did well without him. I think 12-6 without him so far in this stretch where he's been injured. You know, treaded water, more than treaded water during this stretch, kept up a pretty good clip. But obviously, when you get to the playoffs, you need all your best players. You want all your best players healthy. Carl Anthony Towns is a huge part of that, like I wrote yesterday. And we will see what he has if indeed he does play tonight against Atlanta. That will do it for me today. Hope you guys enjoyed everything this week. Some good stuff coming up next week. Planning to have an interesting look at a new book about Division III basketball and how that impacts the NBA. An interesting new book. So I'll have an interview with one of those authors next week. Hoping also to engage with Tom Curran. Covers the Patriots out in Boston. Want to talk to him about the Patriots draft mindset, so I think I'm going to have him on a show next week as well, so listen for that in addition to everything else. Royce on Monday as usual. Until then, I am Michael Rand. Have a great rest of your weekend, great rest of your Friday. Back at it again on Monday.